Good afternoon, everybody. Please pardon me while I move the fan. Now you know, I'm the one with the allergies. And if that thing starts blowing on my nose, we're going to spend the whole afternoon sneezing. So, skip that. I want to speak to you today about a book that's in the Bible that doesn't mention God. And you kind of wonder, well, what's it doing in the Bible if it doesn't mention God? You know, you'd think that it's the Bible. It'll have something to say about God, right? It's the book of Esther. And God's name does not appear anywhere in the Bible. Now, I know, I've heard this before, you can take certain manuscripts, and if you kind of run an acrostic, you might see the name of God sideways. Is that the way most of us? I mean, I don't have a manuscript that does that. I don't have manuscripts. I wouldn't know, I wouldn't recognize it in Hebrew. So for those of us who are looking at it and reading it, and God doesn't appear in it, what's this all about? Now in the spring, you'll hear about Purim, which the Jews celebrate, and they're celebrating the story in this book, but we don't celebrate it. Why is it in the Bible? Is it just a history of a celebration? Is it just, you know, so we have kind of have some history of what went on? Is there anything else? Is there anything in there that has any relevance to us? Esther concerns events that happened in Persia in the reign of Xerxes, who died around 465 BC. The Persian Empire then was strong. It ruled a vast territory. The main characters we're going to come across are Esther and her uncle Mordecai, who raised her. And they're Jews. Now, the first point is that they're from the tribe of Benjamin, but, you know, that Benjamin was considered part of Judah, treated like Jews. What are they doing there in Persia? And why is this story there? They were born in exile. The prophets had repeatedly warned Judah that there was a coming punishment if they didn't repent. Punishment in the form of exile. They were going to be taken captive. They were going to be taken off somewhere. They're in exile. So remember, when we're reading what happened to them, this was not intended to be pleasant. This was not like that trip to Greece. This is, they're at the mercy of the king. They're at the mercy of what he wants to do. They're people who are trying to hide their identity. Jews are not popular. It's not their country. Their lives and their behavior were going to be determined by where they were. Esther and Mordecai had not known life in Judah and Jerusalem. They were born in exile. The fact that God is not mentioned there is a problem for some people who look at the scriptures and they say, well, you know, what's this here for? I mean, so it's a story about these two people and, you know, we're going to see. God's presence is assumed. It's understood. They fast and they pray. No, they don't have a temple to go to. They lost that. They went into exile. They don't have a priesthood. They don't have prophets coming to them. They've lost much, and now they have to just depend on God. But all the physical stuff is gone. Okay. The physical things are gone. Everything they'd had before. They're in exile. It's not pleasant. Let's take a look at what is going on and understand why in the world this book is in the Bible. Is there something that we're supposed to learn from it? Yeah, I misplaced the book of Esther. I think it fell out of my Bible. Okay, so let's take a look at chapter 1. The beginning, it came to pass, verse 1, in the days of Ahasuerus. This was the Ahasuerus who reigned over 127 provinces from India to Ethiopia. In other words, he was tough, he was big, he had a big empire. In those days, when King Ahasuerus sat on the throne of his kingdom, which was in Shushan the citadel, that in the third year of his reign he made a feast for all his officials and servants, the powers of Persia and Media, the nobles, the princes. I mean, this guy, when he threw a party, he could throw a big one. We're going to see inaugural balls coming up in January. Nothing like this. He showed the riches of his glorious kingdom, the splendor of his excellent majesty for many days, 180 days at all. When they were completed, the king made a feast lasting 7 days for all the people who were present in Shushan the citadel, from great to small. Now imagine, there's 7 days of banqueting and drinking. We're not talking about totally sober people at the end of this. You know, that was not the idea. So there were white and blue linen curtains fastened with cords of fine linen, purple, silver rods. All this description here, archaeology tells us this is all true. This happened. And the wealth was fabulous. Verse 7, they served drinks in golden vessels, each vessel being different from the other, with royal wine in abundance, according to the generosity of the king. There was a lot to drink, and everything was wonderful. In accordance with the law, the drinking was not compulsory, for so the king had ordered, and that they should do according to each man's pleasure. And then the queen had a similar banquet. Verse 9, Queen Vashti also made a feast for her women, because that was proper. You know, she was the queen. And on the seventh day, when the heart of the king was merry with wine, doesn't quite say seven sheets to the wind, but he was under the influence, he commanded certain of his eunuchs who served in the presence of the king to bring Queen Vashti before the king, wearing her royal crown, in order to show her beauty to the people and the officials, for she was beautiful to behold. So she's beautiful, and he's kind of under the influence, and he says, bring the queen. I want everybody to see how beautiful she is. According to Jewish tradition, he ordered that she wear the crown and nothing else. So we can see why maybe she's a little uncomfortable with this. Verse 12, Queen Vashti refused to come at the king's command brought by his eunuchs, and the king was furious. He burned with anger. He wanted to show off how beautiful his wife was, and wouldn't you know it, she's not going with the program. So, verse 13, he said to the wise men who understood the times, all of these, he said, verse 15, what shall we do to Queen Vashti according to the law, because she did not obey the command? And they say, well, Queen Vashti has not only wronged the king, but also the princes and all the people who are in the provinces. We've got to do something about this. Yes, it was a concern about all women also, but they're saying, and quite properly, Machiavelli noticed this, if the prince is weak, the people under him will become strong. You lose your strength, and others will take it from you. So he's got to do something. Verse 17, the queen's behavior will become known to all women so that they will despise their husbands. He said, we've got a problem in the whole empire now. We've got to show that this will not be tolerated, and she's going to pay for this. So this very day, the noble ladies of Persia and Media will have to say to the king's officials that they have heard of the behavior of the queen, and there will be excessive contempt and wrath. Oh, this is bad news. So if it pleases the king, let a royal decree go out from him. Let it be recorded in the laws of the Persians and the Medes, so that it will not be altered, because when things are written down in the laws of the Persians and the Medes, they can't be changed. This is not, when we think about a good human government, because humans are not capable of perfection, but this is how they did it. You know, once it's there, that's it. It's like it's in stone. So it will not be altered, that Vashti shall come no more before King Ahasuerus, and let the king give her royal position to another who is better than she. So she is going to lose her royal position, and she is in trouble. Now, this doesn't affect Esther and Mordecai yet, does it? Look at the setting. They're in exile in a pagan culture that engages in practices not supported by the Bible. Now, you know, you tell your wife to appear naked and she refuses, you're gone. Are there any issues for a Christian today in this? We live in a culture that's not supported by the Bible and many of its practices. In many ways, it wants to move further from the Bible. We live in a culture that doesn't particularly welcome our beliefs. Let's take a look at Matthew 10, verse 16. Matthew 10, verse 16. Behold, I send you out as sheep in the midst of wolves. Oh, yeah, right. It's a pagan culture, isn't it? Therefore, be wise as serpents and harmless as doves. But beware of men, For they will deliver you up to councils and scourge you in their synagogues. A warning that we will find that we're not part of the culture and that it may turn on us. You will be brought before governors and kings for my sake as a testimony to them and to the Gentiles. When we deliver you up, do not worry about how you should speak. It will be given to you how you should speak. The purpose of our interaction with society in difficult circumstances may be a testimony. It may be, you know, this is marked that this situation is going on. This is not what God wants. Verse 21, brother will deliver a brother to death. A father his child, children will rise up against parents. And you will be hated by all for my name's sake. He endures to the end will be saved. We've lived in relative peace, you know. There seems to be an increasing resentment and hostility toward all forms of Christianity, but remember this warning. So, and he said, remember, when they persecute you, you flee to another. Look at what happened to Christ during his ministry. Don't be surprised if you are not applauded for your beliefs. They don't like it. And you hold them because they are true, not because they are popular. Verse 26, therefore do not fear them, for there is nothing covered that will not be revealed, hidden that will not be known. And down in verse 30, but the very hairs of your hair are all numbered. Do not fear, therefore, you are of more value than many sparrows. So we're about to see some choices that were made in this story of Esther and Mordecai when fear could have been overpowering. Christ tells us in the trials we may face and what may happen, don't be afraid. Therefore, whoever confesses me before men, I will confess him before my Father who is in heaven. Now, going back to Esther, chapter 2. After these things, verse 1, when the wrath of King Ahasuerus subsided, he remembered Vashti, what she had done and what had been decreed, and he asks his advisors, what should I do about this? There's a little bit of history to insert there. He had gotten into a war with the Greeks, and it had not gone well. He was not doing as well as he wanted. So now, as many politicians say they will, he focused on domestic affairs with laser-like attention. In other words, well, we won't worry about that right now. And he asks the guys what should be done. The women here may say there was no woman advising him. They say that because of what the advice was. I think they're right, you know. He was getting advice from the other men, and they said, man, she really showed you up, and we've sent out orders that this can't be put up with. So, verse 2, the king's servants who attended him said, let beautiful young virgins be sought for the king. Let the king appoint officers in all the provinces of his kingdom. And he gather all the beautiful young virgins to Shushan, the citadel, into the women's quarters, and they're going to be under the care of the eunuchs. Verse 4, then the young woman who pleases the king will be queen instead of Vashti. And it sounded like a good idea to him. Now, notice, they go into the different provinces and they don't say, would anybody like to fill out an application? You know, it's kind of like Miss University, you think you can compete, you want to... No. They've gone out and they've looked at the beautiful woman and say, hey, you, over here. And guess what? You're now part of a harem. And that's what happened to Esther. And you ask yourself, well, what's going on here? They're taking these people out there by force. They didn't ask them if they wanted to do it. Guess what? This is a despot. He has absolute and total power, unless he writes something on stone, then he has to work around it. But otherwise, this is it. And Mordecai, verse 7, brought up Hadassah, that is Esther, his uncle's daughter, for she had neither father nor mother. The young woman was lovely and beautiful. When her father and mother died, Mordecai took her as his own daughter. So he's raising his orphaned niece. And along comes these guys from the king. So when it was the king's command and decree were heard, many young women were gathered. Guess what? Esther ends up also. And you're asking yourself, how did a nice Jewish girl end up in a harem? Well, guess what? They're in exile. And it's not pleasant. And the prophets had said, this is not going to be fun. You know, it's called punishment. And there she is. She's experiencing some of it. So Esther was brought into the king's palace under the care of that particular eunuch. And as the way it went, a woman would go one night spend the evening, the night with the king, and if he liked her, she'd be queen. If not, she went from harem A to harem B. Rejects. She'd spend her life there. What a nice career path, huh? You know, I mean, it's like this is what you had in mind. No, this isn't what they had in mind that they wanted to do. So, verse 10, Esther had not revealed her people or family, for Mordecai had charged her not to reveal it. There's speculation as to why, but they're Jewish and out of sight, out of mind. You know, it just, we won't talk about this. Verse 11, every day Mordecai paced in front of the court of the women's quarters to learn of Esther's welfare and what was happening to her. And what we read in here and what commentators have noticed, it appears that Mordecai held a position of some trust in the government. And he was normally at the palace. So, verse 13, thus prepared, each young woman went to the king. She was given whatever she desired to take with her. And verse 14, the evening she went, and in the morning she returned to the second house of the women to the custody of this eunuch who kept the concubines. Oh, career path, you're a concubine. She would not go to the king again unless the king delighted in her and called for her by name. So, you get to grow old in room B. You are the group of the rejects. Now, when turn came for Esther, she does all she can. She finds out everything that's there. And she goes into the king. Verse 17, the king loved Esther more than all the other women, and she obtained grace and favor in his sight more than all the virgins. So he set the royal crown upon her, made her queen instead of Vashti. Do you see something strange in this? A Jewish orphan has now become queen of Persia? We call that a coincidence? We're going to see a lot of coincidences in this story. We don't see God appearing. We don't have him on top of a mountain with thunder and lightning. We don't have the priests sacrificing. We don't have prophets showing up and preaching. But it appears that God is there, unless you think, yeah, you know, she was a good-looking woman, so she became queen. A Jewish orphan, right. Queen of Persia. Think about it. So, the coincidences are going to begin to mount. Verse 18, then the king made a great feast for the feast of Esther. Feast of Esther, she's becoming queen. All his officials and servants are there. He proclaims a holiday. The virgins were gathered together a second time. Mordecai sat within the king's gate. Now Esther had not revealed her family and her people, just as Mordecai had charged, for Esther obeyed the command of Mordecai as she had been brought up by him. In those days, while Mordecai sat within the king's gate, two of the king's eunuchs, Bigthan and Teresh, doorkeepers, became furious, sought to lay hands on King Ahasuerus. This is called a plot to assassinate him. So the matter became known to Mordecai, who told Queen Esther. Esther informed the king in Mordecai's name, and when an inquiry was made, it was confirmed they were hanged on the gallows. And it was written in the book of the Chronicles in the presence of the king. Coincidences are beginning to mount, aren't they? Why is it that Mordecai finds out about a plot to kill the king? And he tells Esther. And it's now written down in the book that Mordecai did this. But nothing's done to reward Mordecai. Coincidence after coincidence. It's uncharacteristic that the king would not acknowledge that kind of loyalty, that kind of help. You know, saved his life. At least throw a party. I mean, do something for him, right? Nothing. After these things, King Ahasuerus promoted Haman, the son of Hammedatha, the Agagite, and advanced him and set his seat above all the princes who were with him. Now, the fact that he was an Agagite is important. Jewish tradition considers him to have been a descendant of the Amalekite king Agag. Agag was an enemy of Israel during Saul's reign. The Amalekites were the ancient enemies of the Jews. You can go back to Numbers 24 and read how there was a dust-up between Israel, still in the wilderness, and the Amalekites. Saul was instructed to destroy the Amalekites. He didn't do it. He kept the king. Consequently, the kingdom was taken from him. This was serious stuff. 1 Samuel 15, it says that because he disobeyed God, the kingdom was taken from him. This was the final straw. The author is informing us here perhaps rather subtly, that this dispute keeps on going between the Amalekites and the Israelites and has been inherited by Haman, a descendant of Agag, and Mordecai, a descendant of Saul. At any rate, the people who are the enemies of the Jews and want to kill them, one of their principal people is now the king's prime minister. So, all the king's servants, they had to bow down for this guy when he came by concerning him. But Mordecai would not bow or pay homage. The king's servants who were within the gate said to Mordecai, "Why do you transgress the king's command?" And it happened when they spoke to him daily, he would not listen to them. He couldn't. He felt that there were a number of things going on, the dispute between the Jews and the Amalekites. This is our sworn enemy. I'm not going to bow to him, period. If I'm bowing to him, I'm recognizing that he has some sort of almost divine presence. I'm just not going to do it. Mordecai had told them, however, he was a Jew. When Haman saw that Mordecai did not bow or pay homage, Haman was filled with wrath. But he disdained to lay hands on Mordecai alone, for they had told him of the people of Mordecai. They told him he's a Jew. And he said, I think he knew his history. He knew enough to know, we hate these people. Let's get rid of them. You know, this guy is disrespecting me. He is not showing. You disrespect me. You're not showing me what I need to say. Okay, so what do I do? He kills him. He decides he's going to kill not only him, but his whole family. Get rid of this problem. So, we're getting to the heart of the problem. Destroying, and why this book is here. He wants to destroy all the Jews in the empire. Destroying all the Jews in the empire would mean destroying pretty much all the Jews. It's a threat to destroy a people whose continued existence is essential to God's plan. God is allowing us to see both the threats that can come against his people and how he can intervene to save them. What happens if all the Jews are destroyed? Well, we've got prophecies that say the Messiah has to go to Jerusalem first time, and he has to die there for the people. And if there's no temple, there's no priesthood, there are no Jews, what's he going to do? Go to Rome? Well, with Jupiter and Mars and Venus and all these others, and he said, I'm the Son of God. And they're going to say, which one? And where did this come from? In the Bible, what's that? We don't have that. Well, a Jew? Assuming there were some left that he could be born to? No, it was necessary, very necessary, for the Jews to return from exile, to return to Jerusalem, and ultimately to have everything that they would try to do to observe God's law, to have the temple, to have the sacrifices. When Jesus Christ was on trial, the high priest, after they tried to find all kinds of things to charge him with, you know, it's a blasphemy, you said you're going to destroy the temple, you were against Caesar. Finally, the high priest, in frustration, turns to him and says, are you the Son of God? And he says, yes. And the high priest tears his clothes, which is what you do in a blasphemy trial if you're the high priest, tears his clothes and he says, you have to die. They had been acting this out for hundreds of years. Finally, the high priest sees the Lamb of God and he says, you have to die. This is the same high priest who about 1 week before, it says in the scripture, had made a prophecy saying, it is necessary for one man to die that all may live. He dies, everybody lives. He doesn't die, everybody dies. So, they had to be there. They had to go back to the temple. They had to have everything that the Jews were going to do. And also there's another thing why Satan wants to destroy the Jews, apparently, is they are a living testimony to the Scripture. They have not lost their identity. And when people say, who are you, if a Jew is going to answer, honestly, he's going to have to start out saying, there's a man named Abraham who lived in Ur of the Chaldees, and God appeared to him. You know, he takes them through the story. Egypt. Going out of Egypt, who would believe this? You know, destroys Egypt, brings it down. They were slave people, and now they have a country. And yeah, the whole story. Who are you? I'm one of the people from the book, from the promise. But if you can destroy all of them, there's no promise, there's no book, there's nothing. Satan hates them. So God allows threats to come against his people, and he will intervene to save them. And sometimes he will use interesting circumstances. Let's look at Acts 8. Acts 8, verse 1. Now Saul was consenting to his death, talking about when they stoned Stephen to death. And at that time a great persecution arose against the church, which was at Jerusalem, and they were all scattered throughout the regions of Judea and Samaria, except the apostles. Where's God? Well, he's doing exactly what he wants done. The church is now spreading out from Jerusalem. If you had been, and the church was Jewish primarily, if you had been in Jerusalem, somebody said, let's go, you know, move to other countries and spread around and preach the gospel, you probably would have looked at them and said, well, not me, thank you. They had to go. They had to go because of persecution. God works with circumstances. And in this particular case, in Esther and Mordecai, he is working with circumstances, not just to get these two Jews out of a jam, because he could have done that any number of ways, but also because it's necessary for the Jews to continue to exist so they can return to Jerusalem so that the Messiah can later go to Jerusalem and fulfill his prophecies that he already has in place. God's people then can be subject to persecution. God will deliver them. No one can destroy all of the people of God. That's one of the lessons from this. People can destroy some of them. They can attack them. They can persecute them. But they cannot destroy all of them. Matthew 16. Matthew 16, verse 15. He said to them, who do you say that I am? Simon answered and said, you're the Christ, the Son of the living God. Jesus answered and said to him, blessed are you, Simon Bar-Jonah, for flesh and blood has not revealed this to you, but my Father who is in heaven. God reveals his truth to whom he chooses. Not everyone at this time can understand these things. And I also say to you that you are Peter, and on this rock I will build my church, and the gates of Hades will not prevail against it. The church will survive. So, going back to chapter 3, verse 7, the origin of Purim, which has to do with lots, they cast lots. And they're casting lots for the most auspicious time to destroy the Jews. Verse 8, then Haman said to King Ahasuerus, he's plotting against them, there is a certain people scattered and dispersed among the people in all the provinces of your kingdom. Their laws are different from all other law peoples. They do not keep the king's laws. Therefore, it is not fitting for the king to let them remain. They stand out. They don't go with the program. They have a different set of laws. Let's kill them. Verse 9, if it pleases the king, let a decree be written that they be destroyed. And he said, I'll pay 10,000 talents of silver into the hands of those who do the work to bring it into the king's treasury. So the king took his signet ring from his hand, gave it to Haman, the son of Hammedatha, the Agagite, the enemy of the Jews. And the king said to Haman, the money of the people are given to you to do with them as it seems good to you. They're against me. They're bad people. I take your word for it. You're my prime minister. Kill them. This is not what we think is a good day. So, and it's a bit of a bribe that's being offered. Verse 13, letters were sent by couriers into all the king's provinces to destroy, to kill, and to annihilate all the Jews, both young and old, little children and women, in one day, on the 13th day of the 12th month, which is the month of Adar, and to plunder their possessions. If you need an incentive to do this, you get to keep what you find. Kill them, and their property is yours. It's something that happened to the Jews a number of times, even in the Middle Ages. They were accused of being responsible for the plague. One of the things that came out of that when you accused them of being responsible for the plague and you killed them was you had to take their possessions. You know, they couldn't use this stuff anymore, right? They were wealthy. So, yeah, there was an incentive, and here there's an incentive. So a copy of the document was issued as law in every province, being published for all the people, that they should be ready for that day. They hastened out, and the king and Haman sat down to drink, but the city of Shushan was perplexed. Yeah, people don't know quite what to make of this. This sounds very bad, but the king and his prime minister, they're going to drink. Chapter 4, verse 1. When Mordecai learned all that had happened, he tore his clothes, put on sackcloth and ashes, went out into the midst of the city. He cried out with a loud and bitter cry. He went as far as the front of the king's gate, for no one might enter the king's gate clothed with sackcloth. And in every province where the king's command and decree arrived, there was great mourning among the Jews, with fasting, weeping, and wailing, and many lay in sackcloth and ashes. In other words, they understood what this meant. We're all going to die. The king has decreed that we should be killed. They fasted and they mourned. Notice that is the correct reaction to a terrible situation, and we're going to see that Esther also does it. But in Matthew 9, we see Christ's instruction on this. Matthew 9, verse 14. Matthew 9:14. Then the disciples of John came to him, saying, "Why do we and the Pharisees fast often, but your disciples don't fast?" Right? What, you know, everybody's supposed to fast, right? Well, Jesus said to them, "Can the friends of the bridegroom mourn as long as the bridegroom is with them?" He was right with them. They didn't have to fast to ask for his intervention, to draw close to him. "But the days will come when the bridegroom will be taken from them, and then they will fast." Okay, so there comes a time when Christians also must fast and draw close to God. The Jews understood this. They understood they were under a death sentence. They all decided that they too were going to have to fast. So the decree goes out, and Mordecai, verse 8, gave a copy of the written decree for their destruction, which was given to Shushan. He might show it to Esther and explain it to her, that he might command her to go into the king to make supplication to him and to plead before him before her people. So he returned, told Esther the word. The servant tells Esther the words of Mordecai, and Esther spoke to Hathach and gave him a command for Mordecai. All the king's servants and the people of the... And by the way, Herodotus confirms this is true. This is how it worked. You know, this isn't just made up for the sake of the story. All the king's servants and the people of the king's provinces know that any man or woman who goes into the inner court to the king who has not been called, he has been one law, put all to death. Except, one exception, the one to whom the king holds out the golden scepter that he may live. Yet I myself have not been called to go into the king these 30 days. It's been a month. He hasn't called to see me. Still isn't calling to see me. And I'm supposed to show up at the door and say, "I want to see you"? That's certain death unless he decides to extend his scepter. So they told Mordecai Esther's word, and Mordecai told them to answer Esther, "Do not think in your heart you will escape in the king's palace any more than all the other Jews. You're going to be found out. You're going to die too. For if you remain completely silent at this time, relief and deliverance will arise for the Jews from another place, but you and your father's house will perish." He said, "Look, God will rescue us. I trust God, but you won't play along. You're probably going to die." And then he had something very interesting. "Yet who knows whether you have come to the kingdom for such a time as this?" Have you ever thought you're a Jewish orphan? You're nobody. And because of this sets of circumstances, and the king decided he really liked you, you're a beautiful woman, you're now queen. You ever think that this just happened for no good reason other than that you're good looking? No. Perhaps you've come to this time for this purpose. Esther heard it. Verse 15, Esther told them to reply to Mordecai, "Go, gather all the Jews who are present in Shushan and fast for me. Neither eat nor drink for 3 days, night or day." This is the reaction. You're under stress. A trial has come your way. You need God's help. Doesn't hurt to fast. And she realizes she's putting her life on the line. My maids and I will likewise fast, and I will go to the king, which is against the law. Now this woman had steel in her spine. She said, "And if I perish, I perish." Okay. We ask God for his help. And if I die, I die. So Mordecai went his way and did according to all that Esther commanded him. By the way, men, if you think women aren't capable of this, the answer is yes, women are capable of this. And she was the one that God chose out of all the Jews to bring about this solution. So the answer to the question, why me? God has purposes he works out. the coincidence can become an even greater coincidence. When the persecution arose against the Christians, what happened? The gospel was spread. The church was spread throughout other lands. Perhaps some thought it was for such a time and purpose that they had been called, be kicked out of Jerusalem so that they could go talk to other people. So, in a time of great crisis, she went to God for help, and then she showed real grit. She was resolved to do this because it had to be done, even if it meant her death. She did not know. All she could do was beseech God, to trust God, and act. So, chapter 5, verse 1. And Herodotus, I said, has pointed out that this is how things were done, that this really is true. Now it happened on the third day that Esther put on her royal robes and stood in the inner court of the king's palace, across from the king's house, while the king sat on his royal throne in the royal house, facing the entrance of the house. Notice, she knew her king. She puts on the royal robes. She fixes herself up. She knows her husband. She knows who he's married to. She's got to move him a little. Okay, she doesn't show up in her bathrobe and say, "Hey, Buster, there's something I want you to do." She puts on her royal robes. She stands in the door. And so it was, verse 2, when the king saw Queen Esther standing in the court, that she found favor in his sight, and the king held out to Esther the golden scepter. She's going to live. Step 1, this is a process. Then Esther went near and touched the top of the scepter, and the king said to her, "What do you wish, Queen Esther? What is your request? It shall be given to you, up to half the kingdom." That's an expression in the Middle East. That doesn't mean he was going to just sever the kingdom in half and she'd have all these provinces. He means, "I'll just give you all kinds of things. What do you want?" She knows her king. He likes to eat and drink. So what does she do? She invites him to a banquet. Right. She knows how to move this guy's heart. So Esther answered, "If it pleases the king, let the king and Haman, your prime minister, come today to the banquet that I have prepared for him." Then the king said, "Bring Haman quickly, that he may do as Esther has said." So the king and Haman went to the banquet that Esther had prepared. And this goes on. At the time, the king said to Esther, "What's your petition?" And she said, "I want to do this again. My petition is request is this: if I have found favor in the sight of the king, if it pleases the king to grant my petition, let the king and Haman come to the banquet, which I will prepare for them tomorrow." The king likes this. You know, we see earlier in the book, he likes banquets. He throws some good ones himself, and I'm sure the food was not just hot dogs. You know, this was good food, lots of good wine, and he was a happy man. Verse 9, Haman went out that day, joyful and with a glad heart, but when Haman saw Mordecai in the king's gate, and he did not stand or tremble before him, he was filled with indignation against Mordecai. This Jew is going to ruin my day. Nevertheless, Haman restrained himself, went home, and he sent out to his wife and his friends. He tells them about all these things that are going on, in which the king has promoted him, how he's been advanced. And then he said, "Besides, Queen Esther invited no one but me to come in with the king to the banquet that she prepared. And tomorrow I am invited by her along with the king. But this isn't worth anything because I see Mordecai the Jew in the king's gate. His wife Zeresh and all the friends say, 'Let a gallows be born, be built, 50 cubits high.' Then in the morning suggest to the king that Mordecai be hanged on it. Then merrily go with the king to the banquet." And Haman's like, that's not a bad idea. I get rid of this guy. He's trouble. You know, we'll have big gallows. He'll be hanged from it. Yeah, that's the way to go. So, it's a condition of human nature, isn't it, that spite and hatred can destroy what seems to be a really good time. And how many times do we let someone's presence ruin our own whole day? Well, he'd let things ruin the day, but this was a circumstance God's working with. You say, everything's going against them. The Jews are all going to be killed, and now Mordecai, who's working to save them, he's going to be hanged. I mean, how much worse can it get? Let's look at another coincidence that just happens. Esther 6, verse 1, "That night the king could not sleep. So one was commanded to bring the book of the records of the Chronicles. They were read before the king, and it was found. He was told about the guys who tried to kill him. And the king said, 'What honor or dignity has been bestowed on Mordecai for this? How did we show our appreciation?' And the king's servant said, Nothing has been done for him. That's very unlike the king. Is this just a coincidence? Or is this something that God put in place because he has it in mind that he is going to save the Jewish people, set things up to fulfill prophecy? So the king, who was in the court, said, "Who is in the court?" And Haman had just entered the king's palace to suggest that the king hang Mordecai on the gallows that he had prepared for him. The king's servant said to him, Haman is there standing in the court. And the king said, "Let him come in." Haman is asked, "What shall be done for the man whom the king delights to honor?" And Haman thought in his heart, "Well, that has to be me. I mean, yeah, who else is the king going to want to honor?" This is, by the way, fulfillment of the book of Proverbs, just so that we can see it. Proverbs 16:17. Proverbs 16:17. "The highway of the upright is to depart from evil, but he who keeps his way preserves his soul. But pride goes before destruction, and a haughty spirit before a fall." And yeah, Haman's got a problem with pride, doesn't he? They say, "Who? What should we do for the man the king wants to honor?" And he said, "It's me. Who else? Who else but me?" Proverbs 11:2. Proverbs 11:2. "When pride comes, then comes shame, but with the humble is wisdom." So we're seeing illustrations of this here. Haman assumes he's the one to be honored. Who else could it be? Now notice, Mordecai comes out of his house that morning, and they're building a gallows. You know, you come out of your house and you see a gallows being built, and you say, "What's that?" "It's a gallows." "For whom?" "For you." That can just ruin your whole day. Yeah. And this is what he's facing. We're seeing illustrations here of how quickly things can turn to where they from where they have been until something else that God has in mind. So Haman answered the king, "For the man the king delights to honor, let a robe be brought. This is verse 7, "which the king has worn, and a horse on which the king has ridden, and a royal crest placed on his head. And then let the robe and the horse be delivered, one of the king's most noble princes, that he might array the man to whom the king delights to honor, then parade him on a horseback through the city square, and proclaim before him, 'Thus shall it be done to the man whom the king delights to honor.'" And he saw himself sitting on the horse, and he thought, "This is not bad." And the king said to Haman, "Good, do that to Mordecai." Your circumstances are starting to change, right? God does have control of everything, even though it looks ugly. I mean, Mordecai has been told he's going to be hanged, and now they're going to parade him around on a horse with the royal crown on top, saying, "This is how the king wants to honor people who he likes." So Haman took the robe and the horse, arrayed Mordecai, led him on the horseback, and he had to make the proclamation. He had to be saying, "Thus shall it be done to the man whom the king delights to honor." So Mordecai went back to the king's gate. Haman hurried to his house in mourning with his head covered, and he told his wife and his friends what's going on. Zeresh, his wife, gets the full picture. She says, "If Mordecai, before whom you have begun to fall, is of Jewish descent, you will not prevail against him, but will surely fall before him." She understands he's a Jew, you're an Amalekite, and you've gotten into a battle with him, and you're losing. It's going to go bad for you. While they were still talking, the eunuchs come to bring him to dinner. So, what can God do? Well, God can act very suddenly when he needs to. Let's look over in Revelation 17. Revelation 17. Having a vision now of the end times. "The waters which you saw where the harlot sits are peoples, multitudes, nations, and tongues. The 10 horns which you saw on the beast, these will hate the harlot, will make her desolate and naked. For God has put it in their hearts to fulfill his purpose, to be of one mind, to give their kingdom to the beast until the words of God are fulfilled. And the woman who you saw is the great city which reigns over the kings of the earth." Chapter 18, verse 1, it thing, he sees what's going on. Verse 2, it says, Babylon the great has fallen, has become a habitation of demons, a prison for every foul spirit, a cage for every unclean and hated birds. And I heard a voice from heaven saying, come out of her, my people, lest you share in her plagues, lest you receive of her plagues, for her sins have come to heaven. Render to her what is just. In the measure that she glorified herself and lived luxuriously in the same measure, give her torment and sorrow, for she says, I sit as queen and am a widow and will see no one. Therefore her plagues will come in one day, death and mourning and famine. Oh yeah. Haman had a long time, but when it came suddenly. When God needs to move, and he will move suddenly, if necessary. He can move suddenly for you. There are many brethren who have talked about how things looked desperate right up to the last moment, and then everything turned around. Guess whose fingerprints were left behind? Okay. In some places it says he comes suddenly. God can change matters very quickly. So, going back to chapter 7. On the second day at the banquet, verse 2, the king said to Esther, what is your petition? And then finally she lays it on the line, verse 3, if I have found favor in your sight, O king, if it pleases the king, let my life be given me at my petition and my people at my request, for we have been sold, my people and I, to be destroyed, to be killed, to be annihilated. Had we been sold as male and female slaves, I would have held my tongue. Although the enemy could never compensate for the king's loss. But by the way, you know, we do a lot of good stuff here. But you know, okay, you know, I could put up with it. King Ahasuerus says, so who is he and where is he who would dare presume in his heart how to do such a thing? I suspect that without a speaker's club training, nonetheless, she prepared for this speech. She had it all worked out in her mind. This is how you build the king up and say there are people who are trying to destroy me. Well, he's had 2 days of good drinking and eating, and this is his beautiful queen. Who's trying to destroy you? So King Ahasuerus answered, who is he? And verse 6, Esther said, the adversary and enemy is this wicked Haman. Haman was terrified before the king and the queen. Yeah, things really turned around fast, didn't they? It started out as a nice day. He's building a gallows for somebody else, and now look at the trouble he's in. The king arose in his wrath from the banquet of wine, went into the palace garden, but Haman stood before Queen Esther pleading for his life, for he saw that evil was determined against him by the king. He realized that he was in deep trouble. When the king returned from the palace garden to the place of banquet, Haman had fallen across the couch where Esther was. And the king totally misread the circumstances, but God had no problem with leading his mind in that direction. And he said, will he also assault the queen while I am in the house? As the word left the king's mouth, they covered Haman's face. They knew what this meant. And the people who were there, the eunuchs who were serving him, covered Haman's face. And they said, look, the gallows 50 cubits high, which Haman made for Mordecai, who spoke good on the king's behalf, is standing at the house of Haman. And the king said, hang him on it. Well, it never came to his mind that that was going to happen. Verse 10, so they hanged Haman on the gallows that he had prepared for Mordecai. Then the king's wrath subsided. It's not over yet. The purpose that God has in all this, if it was just to save Esther and Mordecai, just to get rid of Haman, Haman could have had a heart attack and that's it. No, there's something more that's going on here. Verse 2, the king took off his signet ring, which he had given from Haman, and gave it to Mordecai. Esther appointed Mordecai over the house of Haman. He's becoming prime minister. God could have stopped this whole thing a long time before, but then he would have had to come up with some other plan for the prophecies that had to be fulfilled that he needed the Jewish people for. It would have happened again, knowing who is behind this. Satan is behind it. But now working in the background, working through circumstances and coincidences, a greater purpose can be carried out. Verse 3, Esther spoke again to the king, fell down at his feet, implored him with tears to counteract the evil of Haman the Agagite and the scheme which he had devised against the Jews. We've got to get rid of this plan. And the king held out the golden scepter toward Esther. Esther arose, stood before the king. If it pleases the king, if I have found favor in your sight, She knows how to plead. Let it be written to revoke the letters devised by Haman, the son of the Hammedatha, the Agagite, which he wrote to annihilate the Jews. For how can I endure to see the evil that will come to my people? King Ahasuerus said to Queen Esther and Mordecai the Jew, indeed, I have given Esther the house of Haman, and they have hanged him on the gallows because he tried to lay his hand on the Jews. You yourselves write a decree concerning the Jews as you please in the king's name, and seal it with the king's signet, for whatever is written in the king's name and signet, no one can revoke. Problem is, of course, he's already given the order that they be destroyed. So what are they going to do? Well, there's another way around this. The law is absolute, but there can be another law that kind of makes the first absolute one less absolute. So the king's scribes were called that month in the third month, and they write a command that all the Jews can defend themselves. They're going to be armed. They're going to be able to defend themselves. So now you're told, you kill one, you get to take his property, but if you attack him, he may kill you. Let's just call this whole thing off. I mean, it's no longer interesting. By these letters, the king, verse 11, the king permitted the Jews who were in every city to gather together and protect their lives, to destroy, kill, and annihilate all the forces of any people or province that would assault them, both little children and women, and to plunder their possessions. On one day in the provinces of King Ahasuerus, on the 13th day of the month, which is the month of Adar, and a copy of this goes out, the couriers take it everywhere, and there's no slaughter. Everybody just said, okay, well, let's go have a drink. We'll live another day. We'll do something else. So Mordecai went out from the presence of the king in royal apparel. He's now wearing royal apparel. A blue and white and a great crown of gold and a garment of fine linen and purple. In the city of Shushan rejoiced and was glad. The Jews had light and gladness of gladness, joy, and honor in every province, wherever the king's command and decree came. The Jews had joy and gladness, a feast and holiday. So, what can we learn from all this? And by the way, they go on to make more decrees. They do things that help the Jews, that protect them. Chapter 10, King Ahasuerus imposed tribute on the land and on the islands of the sea, all the acts of his power and his might, and the account of the greatness of Mordecai, to which the king advanced him. Are they not written in the book of Chronicles of the kings of Media and Persia, which unfortunately we don't have today, but we're told they're there? For Mordecai the Jew was second to King Ahasuerus and was great among the Jews and well received by the multitude of his brethren, seeking the good of his people and speaking peace to all his countrymen. Can you believe this? A Jew who was born to people taken into exile, they're slaves, they're nobody. And his orphan niece are now at the top of the government. They're now running things. They're now making things happen the way they need to happen so that prophecies can be fulfilled, so that God's plan can be carried out. It's not about Mordecai and Esther at that point. It's about all that God has already prophesied is going to happen. So, what can we learn from this? Is this just an interesting story? Is this just, maybe, Hollywood gets its hands on it, and you might recognize a few vestiges of it. But, it's the basis for a story, right? Or is there more? First one, I already mentioned, is no one will destroy God's people. In our case, the church will survive. Persecuted and in trouble at times, yes, we're promised that. But the church will survive. Hebrews 11, verse 35. Hebrews 11, verse 35. Talking about the people of faith. Hebrews 11, 35. Women received their dead, raised to life again. Others were tortured, not accepting deliverance that they might obtain a better resurrection. Almost like they were willing to say, as Esther did, if I die, I die. Some had to die. It happened. It has happened to the church. They were trusting in God's purpose. They were aware. They did it in faith. Verse 36, still others had trial of mockings and scourgings, chains and imprisonments, stones sawn in two. Oh, that sounds awful. We have lethal injection now so that it won't hurt. But sawn in two, they were tempted, they were slain with the sword, they wandered about in sheepskins, goatskins, being destitute, afflicted, tormented, of whom the world was not worthy. They were not what the world thought they were. They were destitute, they were afflicted, they were tormented, and the world is not worthy of them. God has a plan, he has a purpose, and yes, apparently some had to die as martyrs. All these, verse 39, having obtained a good testimony through faith, did not receive the promise. God having provided something better for us, that they should not be made perfect apart from us. Even in these circumstances, then, when these people are dying, God is working to establish his purpose. The church will not be destroyed. God has good things in mind for the church. Number two, God works behind the scenes, as well as dramatically in front of everyone. Israel saw the Red Sea part. You can't beat that. Even Cecil B. DeMille had a hard time coming up with something that would convey how dramatic that was. God can work dramatically. He can also work behind the scenes. All you see is his fingerprints that he's left. When you look at all these circumstances and coincidences, such as happened to that orphan and her uncle, yeah, they become the head honchos. Right. God can do this. The Jewish people now saw desperate circumstances there turn very much in their favor quickly. God works with the circumstances. He works with what's going on. He brings about the changes he needs. Let's look at Acts 23. Acts 23, verse 1. Then Paul, looking earnestly at the council, said, "Men and brethren, I have lived in all good conscience before God until this day." And the high priest Ananias commanded those who stood him to strike him on the mouth. And Paul insults him, and they say, "Would you revile the high priest?" He said, "I didn't know that's who it was. Sorry about that." And Paul perceived that one of the part of the Sadducees and the others were Pharisees, and he cried out, "I'm here for the hope of the resurrection," because they couldn't agree on the resurrection. And there was a loud outcry, and they're arguing, they're going back and forth, and there was great dissension. The commander, fearing lest Paul might be pulled to pieces by them, commanded the soldiers to go down, take him by force from among them, and bring him into the barracks. The following night, the Lord stood beside him, said, "Be of good cheer, Paul, for as you have testified for me in Jerusalem, you must also bear witness in Rome." Now, Paul's in jail. He's in prison. He was put there for his own protection because people were trying to kill him. And it says Jesus Christ showed up and said, "Don't worry. Be of good cheer. Just like you testified for me in Jerusalem, you're going to have to testify for me in Rome." And Paul had been told he was going to go to Rome, and I think the idea started to dawn on him. This was not a first-class voyage. The way he would go to Rome was as a prisoner. Because, let's face it, if he showed up as just another Jew, Roman citizen, granted, and he knocked on the door and said, "I want to talk to Caesar," they would have said, "Go talk to one of his subordinates. What do you have?" But if he shows up as a prisoner who is being accused of all kinds of things and the officials have to make a decision, he is going to give his testimony and explain the gospel message, because they have to know, why are you here? What did you say? I'm glad you asked. And off he goes. He had a number of years to work on his speech too. When it was day, they banded together, verse 12, bound themselves, and saying they would neither eat nor drink till they had killed Paul. There were more than 42 who had formed the conspiracy. They came to the chief priests. "We have bound ourselves that we're going to do this." Paul's sister's son hears about it, verse 16. He tells Paul. Paul tells the centurions. They're worried about him because he is a Roman citizen. Take Paul the prisoner. They tell the commander, "And you, this young man has to tell you what's going on." The commander takes him by the hand. He said, "The Jews have agreed to ask you to bring Paul down to the council tomorrow, and don't yield to them because they're going to kill him there." And the commander says, "Don't tell anyone that you've done this." He tells the centurions, "Prepare 200 soldiers, 70 horsemen, 200 spearmen, and go to Caesarea at the hour and provide mounts to Paul." So Paul is just trying to mind his own business. Everything's going bad, and all of a sudden he's got this great military escort taking him down to Caesarea. Why does he have to go down to Caesarea? Because it's going to advance God's plan. The commander writes this long letter explaining what's going on, and he plays himself up pretty well too. They get to Caesarea, verse 33, and they delivered the letter to the governor, and the governor read it, and he understands what's going on. He says, I'll hear you when your accusers have come. And as we know, it goes on. He's held for a while until finally he appeals to Caesar. Oops, he said the magic words. I'm a Roman citizen. I appeal to Caesar. And they said, then you have to go to Caesar. Off to Rome as a prisoner in chains. God had promised him he would go to Rome to bear witness. He just didn't understand what was going on. God works with the circumstances to accomplish a purpose we sometimes don't see at the time. When the Jews were facing the death sentence, they probably did not see God's purpose. Good question how many of them understood the prophecies about the first coming of the Messiah. 2 Corinthians chapter 5. 2 Corinthians chapter 5, verse 4. For we who are in this tent groan, being burdened, not because we want to be unclothed, but further clothed, that mortality may be swallowed up by life. We really want to be changed, transformed, to be in the kingdom. Now he who has prepared us for this very thing is God, who has also granted us the Spirit as a guarantee. For we are always confident, knowing that while we are at home in the body, we are absent from the Lord. For we walk by faith and not by sight. And that was one of the lessons from the book of Esther. We have to walk by faith and not by sight. Things can look very ugly. Circumstances can look bad. We can even be told that someone's just built a gallows to hang you from. What counts is what God's purpose is. We trust in God. We move forward with faith in God. It is God's purpose that we trust in, and we don't let the things around us shake us up. Romans 8. Romans 8, verse 28. For we know that all things work together for good to those who love God, to those who are called according to His purpose. We've seen some of the stuff that happened, we're told, happened to Christians, some of the things that happened to Paul. We're told, no, things work together for good in God's purpose. If God can intervene in such a way then to rescue the Jews in Persia, how much more can He intervene on your behalf? I mean, you're children of God, you're sons of God. He's called you. He has a special purpose for you, for the church. So if He can rescue some people in Persia who were there because of their disobedience, He can rescue us too. Verse 29, for whom He foreknew, He predestined to be conformed to the image of His Son, that He might be the firstborn among many brethren. Moreover, whom He predestined, these He also called. Whom He called, these He justified. Whom He justified, these He glorified. What then can we say to these things? If God is for us, who can be against us? If God is for us, can we be as bold and without fear as Esther was? If God is for us, who can be against us? When God is with us, we do not need to fear. Verse 33. He who did not spare His own Son, but delivered Him up for us all, how shall He not with Him also freely give us of all things? Do you realize how great the price is that God paid for you? You think He's just going to shrug and walk away? He's with you even in difficult times. Think of the price that was paid. You have great meaning and value to God. You are very special. Verse 33, who shall bring a charge against God's elect? It is God who justifies. Who is He who condemns? It is Christ who died and furthermore is risen, who is even at the right hand of God, who also makes intercession for us. The Son of God makes intercession for us. We're not in nearly as bad a situation as the Jewish people in Persia were, who didn't understand perhaps all that was going on. Who shall separate us from the love of Christ? Who shall tribulation or distress? And we've gone through, various ones of us at various times have gone through distress, persecution, famine, nakedness or peril or sword. It said, even if it gets to that, and it can get bad, apparently, but it said, even if it's nakedness or peril or sword, if you're at the point of a sword and somebody wants to kill you with it, and he kills you, you win because you're in the resurrection. Your next moment, you're meeting Jesus Christ. It's all over. We have to remember that we are in God's hands, and whatever he wants will be brought to pass, and we don't have to worry. We walk by faith and not by sight. So a question we must ask is, do we think that anything can separate us from the love of Christ? What problem, what illness, what trial can pull us away from Christ so that we are no longer his, so that he won't care? No. As it is written, verse 36, for your sake we are killed all day long. We are accounted as sheep for the slaughter. Yet in all these things we are more than conquerors through him who loved us. In spite of the dark clouds and troubles, we are more than conquerors because the victory belongs to Jesus Christ. You're his. He paid the price. The victory is his. Verse 38, I am persuaded that neither life nor death, nor angels nor principalities, nor powers, nor things present, nor things to come, whatever it is you might think about that is really terrifying, nor height, nor depth, nor any other created thing, shall be able to separate us from the love of God, which is in Christ Jesus our Lord. This is something to meditate on. Nothing can separate us from God. And one of the purposes, there are several purposes of the book of Esther, but one of the purposes is to remind us that just as nothing could destroy the Jews because it was God's plan, nothing can separate us from the love of God. He has a purpose for us. The price has been paid. He wants to see us in the kingdom. So in the book of Esther, we see that God has a plan and he will carry it out. Circumstances can be used to change what appears to be devastating into a series of events that further God's purpose. In spite of what we might see, we advance by faith, knowing that God can work the coincidences, the events, the decisions, the actions of others even, whatever is happening to accomplish his purpose. We know that God is always sovereign and that his will must and will be done.